My castaway this week is a television executive. He comes from a family of Sephardic Iraqi Jews and was brought up in Manchester and London. He was sent, curiously, to a cathedral boarding school, and after leaving university, he joined the BBC, and he's been there ever since. In a career spanning 27 years, he's risen steadily through the ranks, becoming the head of music and arts, and ending up as the only man to have run both its television channels. His crumpled suits and unpredictability disguise an orthodox corporate temperament. He says that at school he was a comfortable outsider, a phrase that could equally apply to his career at the BBC. He is currently the controller of BBC One, Alan Yentob. Does that strike you as fair, Alan? Do you see yourself as an outsider?
Well, maybe it's a sort of delusion of mine. If you've been ensconced in the BBC for that many years, perhaps you can't call yourself an outsider. But yes, I suppose, coming from an immigrant family, a term that my mother still doesn't like me to use, but I find that that kind of otherness you have is something that is valuable.
But also professionally, it seems to me you take a pride, don't you, in being unpredictable, as I said, in being a bit of a maverick.
Well, that's how my career began, as a maverick. As for the crumpled suits, I remember reading about my wearing Armani suits some years ago, 12 years ago, before I'd ever known how to spell Armani, let alone. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll buy one.
But the relevance of this is that you run now BBC One, which is a mass audience channel. It has to have broad popular appeal. Isn't that more difficult for you because you are not a conventional chap?
I think it's a difficult, ambitious thing to do for anybody, frankly. And perhaps because I ran BBC Two, people thought, well, he's a sort of minority man, elitist, or what have you. But the big idea of the BBC is that all kinds of things should be accessible to a large audience. So the challenge of that is a considerable one.
Can you cultivate the common touch if it doesn't come naturally to you, which is what we've been saying?
Well, I don't think I haven't got the common touch. I don't think I'm a distant
metropolitan trendy.
No, I don't think I'm that at all. I think my experience is very wide-ranging. I have lots of enthusiasms. I've got very eclectic tastes. I don't think there's anything contrived about that. But making, you know, running a channel which has to have popular drama on and getting it right, being able to draw an audience into programmes is a big task for anyone.
Is it the most difficult job you've ever done?
It's a difficult job, but that would be like a wine. It's also the most exhilarating job. As I have said, BBC Two is a wonderful job, so is running Music and Arts. I've been very lucky.
Well, I want to go into more detail about all of that and how you do it in a moment, but tell me first about Alan Yentob on a Desert Island and his music. How honed are these 8 records we're about to hear?
They're chosen for different reasons, I think, all of them, and some of them because they remind me of places and people. They're a trigger in some way. Others because they're just beautiful. They all have in common that the human voice is somehow at the centre of them in some way.
Tell me the first one.
The first is a piece from Act One of Tosca, and really it's because it's callous. It was a recording that I remember seeing. It came live from Covent Garden. Just one act of it was transmitted by Granada Television. It was one of the first pieces of opera on television I ever saw. And also because when I was a child, we had a help who used to come in, who was Italian, and he used to play, started with Mario Lanza records. I always used to think he was in the house. I was used to the radio, but she'd say, I'll ask him to sing again, if you like, if you go to sleep. And then one day she played Callas. And so this is a piece that reminds me of that period, really, and the beginnings.
Duet from Act One of Puccini's Tosca, sung by Maria Callas and Carlo Bergonzi. In fact, Tosca made broadcasting history, didn't it, when you put it on live from Rome a few years ago when you were controller too?
This was an audacious idea, which was to do this opera live from the locations and at the times for which, you know, Puccini wrote them. It was preposterous, really. And then they did it, and my goodness, it worked. It was
but that's
incredible.
The point about running BBC Two, isn't it? You can make it your own. You can indulge your own tastes, and that's what you did there. In a sense, you can't do that at BBC One, can you? It's everybody else's taste, not yours.
Well, there are certain isms on BBC One, and they have to be there. You know, you have to get certain things right. And no, you don't just do the things you want to do. There's a place somewhere for them. You can, your standards, your judgments about what is good and whether it comes up to scratch is important.
But what it has to be is two things at the same time, doesn't it? It has to be both popular and distinctive. Now, it's easy to be one or the other. If you want to be popular, just run Neighbours wall-to-wall. If you want to be distinctive, you just put Middlemarch wall-to-wall. But are the two things compatible, actually? Isn't that what the great struggle is?
Yes, the popular and distinctive. Well, Private Life of Plants, David Attenborough, that has to be. The new season that we're doing this 26-part series of The People's Century to tell the story of the 20th century for a mass audience in 26 hours. Now, those are parts of what you do. At the same time, there is a place, if you like, for the kinds, even when you do game shows and things, I suppose you try to do them as well as you possibly can.
But what you haven't got, and what BBC One has consistently failed to achieve over the past few years, is it hasn't got those good, strong, popular drama series, other than Casualty, that underpin all of those other things, as you say. Now, why not? It begins to look like more than bad luck. ITV has a plethora of them, from from Cracker to Prime Suspect to London's Burning to Peak Practice, Heartbeat, all of them getting way in excess of 50% of the viewing figures when they're on.
Well, that was the story 2 years ago, 18 months ago, when I had been running a channel for 18 months, and I think the turnaround has been remarkable. In 18 months, all those shows which were not working have come off the screen. We now have shows like Commoner's Muck, which won the BAFTA Award for Best Series. We have Hamish Macbeth coming from Scotland. We have Dangerfield. At the same time, we have Roddy Doyle, we have Bugs, we have a whole new run of programmes.
But they're not pulling more than 50% of the audience.
And now let's be clear about this, Sue. I do not, you know, one of my colleagues referred to stonkers, which is what you're referring to. My
blockbusters, we mean by
blockbusters,
stonkers.
Yes. I haven't aimed just to have blockbusters on the channel. I've aimed to get shows achieving substantial audiences. That might be 9 or 10 million, and some will grow to more than that. But I haven't set out to get as many stonkers as I can.
You've only got one, Casualty, is my point. I mean, surely you'd love to have A Touch of Frost or Inspector Morse or Band of Gold, any of the other ones I've mentioned.
Those shows take time to come. They took ITV a long time. They went for a barren period. I want to put interesting work on reaching large audiences. I think the blockbusters will come.
Critics would argue that they're not there because creativity has been crushed by armies of internal task forces and consultants and so on, and market analysis, that somehow programme makers, particularly in the drama department, have lost their sureness of touch. Do you think there's something in that?
Not really, no. I think there has been tremendous change in the BBC, very difficult changes, and it's been a tricky period, but you're talking about a period as well. You're talking about big drama hits. Okay, there have been less than there should have been. There's been plenty of other good work on the screen, and the BBC's share is pretty strong, and the range is still there.
Record number two.
Well, my second choice is South Pacific. This was the first colour film I ever saw. I was taken there by one of the many distant relatives of my mother who used to visit the house and take the boys out. And they took me to South Pacific. It was an incredibly lurid Technicolor, and I still have this very vivid memory of it. I remember every song in South Pacific I can sing, and so many other people share this vice. I can't get the songs out of my head. When I arrived in the BBC, James Mossman was in the arts department, and this was one of the great journalists of the BBC. He had been in Southeast Asia and Vietnam, had an incredible career. And I found this incredible weakness in him as well, that he knew all the songs to South Pacific. And he was my mentor in those days, and some afternoons when he got bored, he'd say, "Do you want to come and do South Pacific?" So we'd go off in the car and go to the Ritz, and we'd go to a corner of the Ritz Hotel in London. We'd have tea, and we'd sing all the songs from South Pacific.
Some enchanted evening, someone may be laughing. You may hear her laughing across a crowded room. And night after night, strange as it seems.
Some Enchanted Evening from South Pacific, sung by Giorgio Tozzi. Tell me about your origins then, Alan Yentob. The family, we said, is Sephardic Iraqi Jews. When did they come to this country?
Well, my mother came during the war years, and my father came later. Most of the Jews who were in Iraq really fled at the time of the creation of Palestine, and really life wasn't safe for them at that time. I was born in London myself, and we lived... My father went into business with my uncle, who was a very brilliant man and a scholar, really, but who felt he had to support his family and lived in Manchester. And they were in the textile industry.
And it became Dent's Gloves, didn't it?
Well, that's part of the family business. Yes, became the gloves. And my brother runs that business and the textile business. And we still have roots, quite deep roots, in Manchester.
Were you supposed to run it as well, this business?
Well, certainly I could have. I think my uncle and my father were a bit disappointed at first and was sort of rather quizzical about the BBC,
did you always intend to give textiles a wide berth?
I certainly did. I had no intention whatsoever of getting into that, although I was a great fan of my father and my uncle.
And you, according to your brother, were rather demanding as a boy. Mm-hmm. I came across a quote in your cutting saying he always wanted to be the centre of attention. Does that ring true?
No, complete lie. I was a bit of a show-off. My father had a lot of patience for it. My mother indulged it, as mothers are wont to. And it was a house in which you could be a performer because there were so many visitors. I was indulged, I think, in that sense.
And are you still, and do you still need to be?
Well, I suppose if you're the controller of BBC One, more people indulge you than should. But perhaps less so than I was in those days.
But do you need it? I mean, is it part of your character?
Need to...
be centre stage?
I suppose it would be a lie to say that I didn't quite enjoy that, yes.
Your headmaster, while I'm quoting Blasts from the Past, your headmaster describes you as very eager and hard-working, but inclined to make up the end before considering the means. That ring a bell too?
Probably. I think that's, oddly enough, now you say that, it sounds quite sensible to me. I'll take that and write it down and pursue it.
It surely can't do in the BBC of today. You've got to know where the means are.
Not at all. I think that if that says, you know, have some vision and then try to get there and don't worry about how you're going to get there, just get on the road. I think that sounds a bit silly, but I mean, if you don't have the vision, you've got nowhere to go, so why start the journey? So that's probably true, and it's probably a failing as well.
He was the headmaster of this public cathedral school that you went to, that you and your brother, twin brother, we should say, were sent to. That was a curious decision, wasn't it, to send you to a cathedral school?
We certainly were the only two Jewish boys at this cathedral school. I never really wanted to go to boarding school. I kind of felt I'd been sent away, and we just arrived 2 or 3 years earlier from Manchester, and London was, you know, fabulous, and I wanted to be in London. And I was a bit of a mummy's boy anyway, so I felt sort of thrown out. So I sort of, essentially, I thought, why am I here? I'm not too much of a country boy either, really, although I'm trying to get into it again. But once I was there, I parked myself and I got on with it.
But that's why you felt a bit like the outsider, is it? Because, A, you wanted to be on the outside, and in any case, as you say, you were the only Jewish boys there.
Yes, although I've never felt myself anti-Semitism in any way, but I certainly didn't feel that I was a typical product of that sort of minor public school system.
Tell me about record number three.
Well, record number three is, I have to say, you know, I do feel genuinely that what a learning privilege it is, having had the job that I've had, going to music and arts department and discovering things all the time. Billie Holiday, for instance, I didn't really know about. I knew her name, but I hadn't listened to her voice and the records. And we made a film about Billie Holiday, and I did, and I was, you know, I was entranced. And this song is called Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday. It's an extraordinary song because it's about the lynching that went on in the South in America. The strange fruit is the body on the tree, hanging on the tree. It's an amazing record.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern
Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit. It was obviously a good school, Alan Yentob, or you were an exceptional pupil because you passed your A-levels age 16 and went off to study in France for a couple of years before going to university here, Leeds, to read law. But you apparently concentrated rather harder on the drama.
When I went to university, I was convinced I was going to do law. I decided that. I could have read English somewhere else, but I wanted to read law. But there was a very good dramatic society at Leeds and a lot of talented people in it, so I got absorbed in the theatre, and I acted early on, and then I started to direct. In fact, we came to London, and I acted in a play which was directed by the BBC's head of serials, Michael Waring, as it happens.
And, so your name was in lights in the West End?
I had Margaret Leighton's dressing room, and I had my photo blown up, sort of much larger than life size, outside the Garrick Theatre.
And then it was 1968, and you entered the BBC, never to leave again, as we've said, 27 years. You were the only non-Oxbridge general trainee of your year, and what's more, you had a second-class degree to boot. That would have made you very unusual. I mean, they always took Oxbridge people, and if they didn't, you certainly had to have a first-class degree. Mm.
I think they thought he could just as well be Oxbridge, so we'll take him. It was one of those. Yes, if you know.
So I
don't know if I'd give any marks to the BBC for that. Well, only that I was sort of confident. I could have gone to Oxford to read English anyway.
But you were offered a place at Oxford.
I was going to go to read English, but I didn't. I wanted to read law, and I had to take Latin, so I waited another year and went to France and came back and went to Leeds. But I never did do Latin.
You got in on this very rarefied general trainee scheme. I mean, they would only have taken a half dozen people a year, if that.
I got in, yes. And the first place I went to was Bush House, which I absolutely adored. You know, it was like the Tower of Babel in The Aldwych, you know. I mean, it never went to sleep. There were all these people who spoke different languages all over the place. The canteen was a kind of a mock with emigres and revolutionaries and would-be revolutionaries. And this was the time, remember, it was near the LSE, and this was the time of the student riots. It was a time of the great, the turbulent events. They seem less great in retrospect, but it was certainly lively at the time in Paris. So it was a very interesting time to be there.
Next record.
Well, there's a bit of a story behind this record. I've chosen a record by the Everly Brothers, but it's about the sort of, I suppose, a cross-fertilisation, the mad, surreal world that you get to when you're an arts producer. And Orson Welles, that we just finished an arena program about Orson Welles, and he'd taken to ringing me quite regularly because he was an insomniac and didn't matter where in the world he was. Anyway, I was at this time in a motel in Kentucky with the Everly Brothers, who had not been talking to each other for 10 years and had just started to talk to each other. We were in a hotel room and Don was playing his records, all the records that Phil hadn't heard, and Phil wasn't playing his, and Phil was being a bit mopey. And then someone walked into the room and said, there's an Orson Welles on the telephone. This is a call for me. So I picked up the phone, and it was indeed Orson. And he said, where are you? And I said, well, I'm in Kentucky with the Everly Brothers. And he said, who are the Everly Brothers? So I tried to explain. He said, any relation to the Everly Sisters? I said, who are the Everly Sisters? He said, well, they ran a brothel in New Orleans. Anyway, I went back into the room, and I saw the two lads, and I've chosen this song because it's called Let It Be Me. It's just one of many Everly Brothers songs, which I love. I love those two voices. So these two rather fatter, stouter men came together again, but I've chosen the thin version of this song, the one that was in their heyday.
So never leave me lonely. Tell me you love me only, and that
the Everly Brothers and Let It Be Me, the subject of one of my Castaway Alan Yentob's arena programmes, as was David Bowie and the Ford Cortina. You did The Private Life of It, I remember, and the Chelsea Hotel in New York, those kinds of subjects. Do you think it was easier in those days to get ambitious programmes like that off the ground, much more than it is today?
I'm not sure whether it was. Perhaps it was in the sense that you took a small idea, popular culture really, and in a sense sort of blew it up and extended it. And I don't think there are necessarily the opportunities that there used to be for that, but I think there's I'm not one of these who buys, oh, television in the good old days was so much better than television today. I think,
Didn't you enjoy it more then? Don't you recall those long hours in the cutting room into the wee small hours arguing mm-hmm. over a 10-second shot with enormous affection?
I do.
Do you wish you were there now?
No, I can be. Now I'm spend the time doing other things and not, I assure you, just bureaucratic things. And I mean, I try still to spend enough time, you know, enthusing about programmes and seeing them and talking about them and planning for them. And it's not to say that I don't see my career as one endless sort of leap up the BBC ladder or anything. I'm very happily one day go back to making programmes and look at
Will
this
you?
Industry. Well, when I say making them, being part of them, motivating people.
Would you like, though, to be Director General first?
No, I have no... I didn't... If you'd have said to me a few years ago, do you want to be controller of BBC One, I would have said no, probably. I don't plan ahead in quite that way. My sights are set on doing this really well and an understanding that I'm going to do an interesting job. The next job I do is going to be an interesting one in a television film, and it will depend what the opportunity is at the time.
But you're not ruling out the top job?
I wouldn't rule anything out. Who knows? I have no idea what will happen, genuinely.
More music.
My next choice is from A Mind of Winter, which is a work by George Benjamin, a young contemporary composer, that most difficult of all occupations. The ambition that I think is in this piece to take the orchestral sounds and to find the human voice and to marry the two together is, I think, terribly interesting. Also, the other thing is it's on the desert island, and this song, this piece of music, is really about the cold and about the frost, and it's based on a poem by Wallace Stevens called The Snowman.
Part of A Mind of Winter, composed and conducted by George Benjamin and sung by Penelope Walmsley-Clark with the London Sinfonietta. George Benjamin, who's a friend, Alan, and you mentioned Orson Welles and the Everly Brothers. I mean, these names that drop fairly regularly from your lips. I know there are stories of you turning
You're telling
up.
Me I'm a name drop.
There are these good jokes about you turning up at parties saying, I brought my friend Orson, I brought my friend Mel. I mean, have you made a point of cultivating these people, or do you just have a natural affinity with them?
Well, I don't know if it's quite like that. But of course, if you have worked in this area for most of your life, you tend to meet people, and I have, I suppose, formed with some of those people lifelong friendships.
But it does make for a glamorous sounding life anyway, mm-hmm. just like people believe television executives' lives are, mm-hmm. and often are not. But on the personal level, your life has become rather more conventional of late. You've had two children in the past years, Jacob you've got, who's four, and Isabella, who's one. A first-time father in your mid-40s, has that had a profound effect on you?
Yes, I'm afraid the boring answer is it has a profound effect on me. I've always loved children, actually. And being a late father, I think you do appreciate them perhaps that much more. However busy you are when later in life, somehow you know how to find the time for the things that matter. And you've got to a point in your life where the things that you can delegate, you can delegate. So, yes, I absolutely adore being a father, I have to say.
Do you think it's altered your professional judgments in any way? I mean, one thinks back to Birth Night that you put on BBC Two. Was that round about the time Jacob was coming? Or
Well, I must admit it was. That's where you talk about you're able to indulge yourself on BBC Two. Well, to some extent you are. You're able to share your enthusiasms with millions of people. It was a very, very, one of those very good nights, that one, I must say, and especially the scenes in the hospital with all the births going on.
But does it also make you jump more readily at an idea like Children's Hospital? I mean, suddenly it gives you a new perspective on life and makes you... It's really what we were talking about earlier, whether you are like-minded with the mass audience. Do you feel now that you know a bit more about them?
I have to know a bit more about them, but I don't think I'm a different person, actually, but I think I'm looking in other directions. Particularly if you're running BBC One, I think to have children, it is a family channel. You want families to watch together.
Record number six.
Well, record number six, this is for Jacob, and it's Hank Williams, better known to him as Panks Williams, which is how he referred to him. Philippa, his mother, she likes Lefty Frizzell, who's a rather obscure country blues singer, but rather wonderful. But Panks always wins out, so this is what we play in the car a lot, and Jacob sings along with him. This one is Your Cheating Heart.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. But sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Hank Williams and Your Cheating Heart. I like your views, Alan Yentob, on the long-term future of the BBC beyond the charter renewal and beyond the millennium. Isn't it inevitable that as more and more channels, satellite and cable come on stream, that the viewing figures will be more and more eroded and that the licence fee will be less and less justifiable? Aren't we living through the last decade of the BBC as we know it?
That's both sort of, I suppose, fair in some ways, in other ways sort of slightly apocalyptic, but we will expect and do expect the share of audience among the terrestrial channels to decline. But the BBC will be showing its programmes, I think, on network television for a long time to come. And I think that the picture we'll get of the industry will be, on the one hand, you will have networks, which will be important, again, if that shared experience is to be important to people. If not everybody wants to programme their own entertainment, but people become more and more familiar with computers, telephones, these will lead to people having options.
But therefore,
there'll still
be
a place, though, for the networks, in my belief.
But they will therefore use BBC One and BBC Two less and less. I mean, can it really go on being a service for everybody funded by a universal licence fee? There comes a point when people will say, look, I really don't watch the BBC that often. Why on earth should I have this tax imposed upon me?
If you looked at the BBC as a subscription, if you like, then the cost...
But it isn't voluntary, that's the point.
No, that's an issue, and maybe we shall see in due course what happens in relation to... Those who say it should simply be a tax. I mean, I've always been a believer in the licence fee. I wouldn't want to, predict quite what in 10 years' time at the end of a charter will happen. However, there's another point, really, about the future, which is to do with the BBC as a producer of programmes. So there's lots and lots of opportunities.
Mightn't it therefore end up doing what people perceive it as doing well, which is making the programmes that the commercial channels don't want to make, the high-quality programmes? It's either that or take advertising, isn't it?
No, there are other ways. I mean, advertising is not the only source of income. I mean, as you say, we say subscription, certainly, just paying for what you get is another. I think the great glory of the BBC is that it is in touch with the mass of the British public.
But will it still be in 10 years' time?
I believe it can be and will be. It may be that through the networks, it's in touch with them in one sense, but there will be other ways which they get access to BBC programming through as well, where they can make choices of their own, which will supplement what it does.
But isn't it possible that you are one of the last, and I mean one of the last, of the controllers of BBC One in the sense that we know it today, who, as you said, sit there in a very privileged position, able to put on the air what you feel is right? I mean, you work hard at it, and it's not easy, as we've said, and everybody thinks they can do it better than you, but it's a great job. Aren't you one of the last people who's going to have that kind of power? And it is a power.
Well, I doubt it, actually. You still need people who can motivate talent, give them opportunities, go with a hunch, even. I mean, all those things are part of what makes it an exciting and vibrant place to be, and I think that whatever television is like, and it will need impresarios to do that.
Record number seven.
Well, this is just a beautiful aria, really, from Così fan tutti, Suave sia il vento. And this is about when the two lads are about to go off to sea, so they say. This is a song before they depart. The two girls and Don Alfonso.
Trio Suave Silvento from Mozart's Così fan tutte, sung by Margaret Marshall, José Van Damme and Agnes Balzer, with the Vienna Philharmonic conducted by Riccardo Muti. Time and enough to ponder all these things, your own future and that of the BBC, Alan, on this desert island. I suspect you will very quickly become deeply bored, won't you?
Yes, I worry about that. I do worry about it.
No telephone?
I gather I'm not allowed a mobile phone.
Certainly
which,
not, no.
Well, I can't imagine why not, but perhaps that's a good discipline.
But does what we're saying about getting bored mean that you're actually not very happy in your own company? You need people.
If there are tasks to be done and things to do, then I would happily want to do them. And I'm not sort of much of an adventurer in terms of physical life adventure. So I think I would be doing a lot of cooking, and I suspect I'm going to have to resort to introspection. But I think I will have to make some capital out of that introspection, one way or another. So I think that my luxury is going to be a video recorder. Now, I know that sounds very banal and very professional, but you see, I'm going to send a video director. It's going to be my equivalent to Alastair Cook's letter from America. And for nostalgia's sake, I'm going to send my little video. It's going to be one of those small ones in a bottle, rather like that arena bottle that floats out to sea, and it's going to come back the next day, and I'm going to think how well it's going down, how good the ratings are, without necessarily knowing, but I'm going to be very optimistic about it.
Last record.
My last record was just a very sublime and beautiful song, sung by a very sublime and beautiful voice, the voice of Jesse Norman. It's one of Strauss's four last songs, Beim Schlafengehen, it's called.
Beim Schlafengehen, one of Strauss's four last songs, sung by Jesse Norman with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Masur. If you could only take one of those records, Alan?
I think, actually, I'd take the Jesse Norman.
Send you to sleep?
Yes. Well, I'm going to have to do a lot of that, I think.
Feed your soul. You've told us your luxury. What about your book?
Well, this is a tricky one. I mean, I thought that the book that would give me some strength and initiative, perhaps, which I'm going to need to be philosophical and cope with all this, was Candide by Voltaire. You know, that philosopher Pangloss is always going, you live in the best of all possible worlds, and when it's patently obvious that you don't, and then ending up cultivating the garden. But it's a very thin book, and I feel, you know, that somehow my bulk buying mentality will not justify it. So I've often dipped into Montaigne's essays, but never quite sort of had the time, or perhaps even in question, but I've always admired them and the thoughts, and I thought to myself, well, this will give me succour and food, make me a much better person, may make me put up with and appreciate the things around me. So I'm going to take Montaigne's essays with me.
And we shall know if it's worked when we receive the first video diary. Alan Yentob, a changed man. Alan Yentob, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.